You're listening to NBC Sports Radio. Weekends. This is Speaking of Sports
with Jim Daniels
on NBC Sports Radio, where every day is game day.
And now,
it's Jim Daniels.
Good morning, and thanks for making us a part of your sports Sunday. This is Speaking of Sports. I'm your host, Jim Daniels, here every Sunday morning where we like to kick the box score aside and take a deeper, longer look at some of the stories and individuals that are making news in the sports world. On the scoreboard, boy, it was blowouts in the NBA playoffs, scary-looking sweep scenarios playing out in the NHL, and the NBA deciding that maybe it's time to put some sponsors on the jerseys. We'll get into these stories and a whole lot more, how the Cavaliers might be derailing the Justin Bieber train, too. And speaking of trains, the Johnny Manziel party train made a stop in Los Angeles, and wow. This has got only really one end scenario, I think, and it's not if, it's when. But we'll talk more about that coming up in just a second because there's other disturbing news in the sports world. Former Saints defensive end Will Smith was shot to death in New Orleans, the Garden District. That happened a week ago, Saturday night. It was following what we thought was just a minor car crash. A fender bender turned into some road rage. Sadly, we watched the his wife completely devastated in a wheelchair attending the memorial service for Will Smith yesterday. His wife, Raquel Smith, 34 years old, was also shot twice in the leg. This is a bizarre story that is gaining momentum and interest as it moves on. So we turn to our legal expert on the program, Drew Sherman, entertainment lawyer for the Adley Law Group in Los Angeles, joins us this morning. Drew, this was really more than a simple case of road rage, wasn't it?
Not just about road rage, although that might be the impetus of this case, but it's really going to be interesting to see how the defense and the prosecution plays this, because we're really talking about two parties that are on equal levels. Essentially, you have, you know, it's not black versus white. This is black and black. This is not poor versus rich. You know, both gentlemen were well off. The shooter, the accused defendant, did not play football, but he played semi-pro football, and he had a little bit of money from a settlement with the city of New Orleans. He's going to have a good lawyer. The prosecution is going to be good. I mean, it's really going to be interesting to see how each side plays this and whether or not the jury pool comes from outside of the city of New Orleans, whether or not the jury pool comes from inside the city of New Orleans, because essentially it's almost going to come down to whether or not they're Saints fans or not. And that's going to be the interesting part of it.
You know, more on the settlement with the city. This is becoming a more significant part of the story as it develops. Cardale Hayes did have some kind of settlement with the city of New Orleans. What was that all about?
Well, apparently back in, I think it was 06, his father actually was shot to death by police officers of the city of New Orleans, is what the reports read. And he brought a litigation against the city of New Orleans and the police department. And he settled out of court with the city and the police department sometime, I believe, in 09. And he was asking for, originally in the lawsuit, I think I saw, was about $5 million. I'm going to assume that he got, you know, maybe a good portion of that, at least half. So he probably got a couple million dollars that he's had for a little bit of time.
Yeah, we know that he's also a business owner, maybe a tow truck company, towing company, something like that. Cardale Hayes is, the man's name. NBC News reported on, I think, Monday or Tuesday that he's accused of killing Will Smith in a fit of road rage, but is saying that he feared for his life as the confrontation escalated, started with just a three-car pileup, but then escalated and sent people running in every direction, with not only he grabbing his gun, but Will Smith apparently going back to his car to get his gun. But he is saying that he's going to plead, his attorney saying that he's going to plead not guilty. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, and actually, from what the prosecution in a criminal case has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant did what they are accusing the defendant of. And when you talk about a self-defense, like, that he was reasonably in fear for his life, that plays a strong role. In Louisiana, the prosecution has to prove that he had no reasonable fear for his life, and that is very difficult to do. In addition, in Louisiana, unlike California, there is a very liberal self-defense law. Essentially, like I said, you have to only have a reasonable, quote unquote, fear for your life. Here in California, for instance, you pretty much have to have your back against the wall with no other place to go to have self-defense. I mean, if I have a place to run away and go to in California, you have an obligation to run away. Well, out on the street, in the middle of the street, if he thought that Will Smith was going to get a gun, which is what the reports are saying is why he was shot in the back or in the side, is because he was reaching into his car for a weapon, and they did find a loaded weapon in Will Smith's car, not used, but loaded. And so at that point in time, if the defendant did have a reasonable fear for his life, he did not have to run away. He could pull the trigger, and he could claim self-defense.
Wow. Drew Sherman is our guest from the Adley Law Group here in Los Angeles. We frequently talk to Drew about some of these athlete cases. You know, New Orleans has got a really bad rap as being a city that struggles with law and order frequently. This is really another example of that town kind of spinning out of control, and then the story spinning out of control right along with it, yeah?
Well, it's scary regardless. And when you go off Bourbon Street and you know why it's scary. But there's from the back of the days of Huey Long in Louisiana, it was never necessarily about law and order, but it was about law and my order, it can be scary when you're dealing in that kind of venue and you don't know what's coming at you, or you don't really know the people that are there to protect you, whether or not they are going to protect you and who's calling the shots. That can definitely be a scary thing.
You know, there have already been a couple of twists and turns in this story, and maybe another one is headed this way. That is especially if the victim winds up being, maybe one of the accused. The concussion or CTE issue might be able to creep its way into this case. Is that right?
Well, most definitely. I mean, listen, that's what I would do if I was, defending the attorney for the defendant. Mm-hmm. I would definitely bring up the whole concussion issue. He's a former football player, been playing, every year for the last, I think it was 10, 12 years. He didn't miss many games, playing interior D-line. The guy is banging his head every year a lot. And we've seen, Junior Seau. We've seen many, many of these ex-football players where they have this concussion syndrome, and they wind up turning to violence on themselves, violence on other people. I mean, that is definitely something that I would bring up if I were defending Mr. Hayes. That would clearly be as part of my plan. Because remember, the prosecution in this case has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. What is it? That's like 99.999% sure that the jury has to be that he did it, and he did it without being, in a reasonable fear for his life. That is a high, high standard. And if you can make any sort of cracks in that case, you are getting your client off. And I think that is clearly where the defense should go here.
A lot more than just the loaded gun in the car of the victim. We will follow this story with great interest as we do all things that whirl around in the sports world. Just an absolute crazy, out-of-control story. Drew Sherman from the Adley Law Group, thanks once again for being with us. We'll talk to you again soon.
No problem, Jim. Take it easy.
Fortunate that we have a lawyer on the payroll around here to unravel some of these things, but somebody else is going to wind up needing a lawyer before long is Johnny Manziel. You know, this story, you talk about in our business stories that have legs. This story has got legs like a freight train. It just will not stop, and neither does his partying. Now, this report from the New York Post, Emily Smith, who writes the page 6 for them, has, I guess, been following the Manziel story very closely, but allegedly, came out to Los Angeles, rented a $4.5 million home, and completely trashed the place. Now, the real estate broker's name in this is Nicholas Goodwin. He's demanding $32,000 in damages from this $4.5 million house that Johnny Football rented for the week, saying that they left the house strewn with booze and drugs, broke an expensive glass table and a bathroom door, left wine stains and cigarette burns everywhere. Mr. Goodwin is quoted as saying, "They were supposed to check out at noon. Manziel was passed out on the couch. There was cocaine all over the kitchen table, and mushrooms were still out on the table in front of him. There was booze everywhere, broken glass all over the floor, and champagne glass in the tree. If they don't respond to our demand for compensation, we will sue," close quote. It's it's an absolute train wreck. Drew Rosenhaus recently in an interview on Sirius said that that Johnny Manziel is out of his stable. He's got a five-day window in order to turn it around. This was a couple of days ago, if he wants him back as a client. And it's just, you know, it's not when this finally comes to an end. It's not if, but when it finally comes to an end and how it's going to come to an end. I don't think that there's anyone that believes for a second that this guy is playing any kind of football. And as we've all kind of discussed around here many times on and off the air, the kid comes from serious big-time oil money in Texas. So I don't think he has any fear whatsoever of the cash faucet ever being turned off. I mean, his money from the NFL, from the Browns, it's only a couple of seasons, you know, that will run out after a while, especially when you're Learjetting yourself around and, you know, playing rock star like this guy is. But, wow, it's just sad and extremely disappointing. I would imagine for Texas A&M fans, as well as just football fans in general in Texas, you know how they are in Texas, how they feel about their football. They love it. Another really frightening story. If you're somebody that's close to Johnny Manziel, you got to think that, you know, at some point, somebody is going to get this guy to give his head a shake a little bit and hopefully turn life around, because this has got a very ugly ending on the horizon. The NBA has approved a 3-year trial of jersey advertising. No, it doesn't mean they're going to turn their jerseys into a NASCAR fire suits anytime soon, but the NBA Board of Governors said that, you know what, it's time for this. So the 2017-2018 season will be part of their 3-year plan. Don't expect it to go away anytime soon. But what it also means is it's opening the door for all of the other sports, and I think it's only a matter of time before you see a Ford sticker on the Lions helmets or you know, something else like that. Maybe the New York Stock Exchange on the Yankee uniforms. I don't know. That's coming. Also coming, our conversation with the professor of sports business. That's Rick Horro. He's next on NBC Sports Radio and NBCSportsRadio.com. NBC Sports Radio, NBCSportsRadio.com. This is Speaking of Sports. Thanks for dialing us up. We appreciate that. The show is brought to you by Grainger, serving you with the products you need to help keep your facility running. Call, click, or stop by today. Grainger, for the ones who get it done. Thanks for being with us. Time now to turn once again to the phone. Our next guest graduated from Harvard Law School. He goes by the sports moniker of the sports professor, also visiting expert for the school's sports and law course. So that means he knows what he's talking about, at least most of the time when we're talking dollars and cents here. Let's get into it with the sports professor, Rick Horro. Good morning, sir.
You sound especially good today. I don't know why. I was listening to you on a serious little shout out, and you sound better today than you have in the past. Why is that?
You know, that's a great question. I don't know. Wish I could answer that. I don't know. Kind of felt that way today too. It's funny that you would say that. It just felt that way.
I know why. I know why. Because the broadcasters union now allows you to wear a little jersey patches on your shirt. So
you know,
more money for you.
I'm trying to get that actually. Yeah, because if we could get off that minimum wage around here with that little patch, that would kind of offset things a little bit. We're gonna
By the way, before you start, I know this is your show, although I'm only, you know, playing a bit part.
Uh-huh.
Shout out to Arizona State. By the way, they have a sports law and a business program they just started to, you know, the Harvard thing is important to me, but Arizona State's really important because they're trying to drive sports, business, law, and journalism in one program. So you're going to be hearing a lot about that in the future. We're going to be using a lot of their information, people, et cetera, to make your show even better. What do you think about that?
Awesome stuff. That's great. Shout out to the Pac-12. We like that. It's good stuff. Let's go international, because the Masters got a real twist last week. We were all prepared to watch Jordan Spieth go back-to-back and get ready for Texas barbecue at next year's Champions Dinner. That's not the way it went down. It was Danny Willett who winds up with the big payday. Talk about how big a payday the Masters is. It's gigantic. This guy went pro in 2008. He's made about $12 million in earnings, so that means in 8 years he's done pretty well. But that Masters payout for one day, almost $2 million, right?
Pretty good. When you and I play and it beats you like a drum, I don't get $2 million. So great second Masters in a row for Jordan. Oh, no, it wasn't. So listen, Danny Willett now is a household name here. It was their comparison to tennis. It took Andy Murray 77 years, my friend, to follow Fred Perry's Wimbledon win. Now, in golf, it's earlier. He's got deals with Callaway Audemars Piguet, a Malaysian hotel chain. Chubby Chandler, remember, he was Rory's first agent, and he is going to make this guy a lot more money than he's made before.
Let's go to Las Vegas now, shall we? Las Vegas has always been a great destination for sports fans, whether it's just to get into the sports book. But you know what? We'd sure like to see some pro teams there. Vegas has opened their latest arena. It's the T-Mobile Arena. The Killers, Wayne Newton, Guns N' Roses, a bunch of people have played there already, a 20,000-seater, so I guess that makes it bigger than the Thomas and Mack. But there's talk that, well, you and I have actually talked about the possibility of an NHL franchise. Now maybe the whisper of an NBA team as well?
Well, either or probably is the answer, but it means that the arena box is checked off of Vegas's can you do it, can you not do it. The big issue is market, corporate support. Do the casinos really, really, really want it, or they just want an event? So once all those questions are answered, and a guy named Foley, who was one of the Fidelity founders, has written the expansion check, do they move a team? Do they expand? Do they expand at the same time as Quebec City? What do they do? What this arena does, by the way, is gives Gary Bettman a lot of options. But it means move kind of quickly because the NBA is saying, well, we may look at this too. Vegas will be a great market, but for one team.
Rick Horro is our guest, a sports professor. We talk the business of sports with Rick every Sunday on Speaking of Sports. In the social media world, boy, quite the coup. The NFL chooses Twitter for its Thursday Night Football streaming package. I'm a little bit surprised at Twitter over Facebook, but I guess Facebook went backed out of this deal?
Well, Facebook didn't offer the kind of long-term partnership assets. The NFL, believe it or not, it's hard for me to say this, is not in it only for the money. They're in it for the exposure down the road, and they're in it to establish the brand. And what the NFL is doing is to say they need to be an all-in real partner. So who'd have thought a few years ago, my friend, that DirecTV would bid for a package along with the traditional guys? Now Yahoo validated the concept. Remember at that Jacksonville-Buffalo game in London last October, and they set this up, and Twitter comes through the door. So you're going to see a lot more of this in the future. Then the money starts rolling into Roger Goodell. Good thing, because he promised his owners $25 billion in revenue in the next couple of years or a few years. So here comes some.
All right, time for my stomach to get into the act as it usually does. Last week when you were at the Masters, we were talking about the fare that's offered at more than reasonable prices. Moving up to Wrigley Field, a lot of expectations. A lot of people would like to see the curse end and the Cubs finally get it done. Part of one of the things that will propel at least the fans in their quest for a championship is a new menu at Wrigley, right?
Yeah. Lackey, Lester, Arrieta. Oh,
no, no, no.
Gilbert's Grill Cart, Friendly Confines Money, Budweiser Bleachers, a lot of different stuff, even Chocolate Deer, Fannie Mae getting into it. And the bottom line is, after the renovation, more opportunities to have more kind of novel foods for Chicagoans. No disrespect to Chicagoans, but give me the brat and the beer. But now, if you want to spend five times that, you can have fancy food.
All right, I want to get into some bling now. The Kansas City Royals are finally getting their royal treatment. That means the World Series rings. Not so much about the ring itself, but one of the things in the Horro Sports Brief that I was shocked at is how many rings they wound up making. Is it 700 rings? Is that correct?
Players, coaches, field staff, full-time front office managers,
wow.
California talk show hosts that show up at 5 in the morning to do NBC Sports Radio. Whole bunch of stuff going on. They decided to spread it out, a regional franchise. They are really good to their people, and why not make rings and make people work harder?
Awesome stuff. Rick Horro, as usual, thanks for being with us on NBC Sports Radio.
You're listening to NBC Sports Radio. Weekends. This is Speaking of Sports with Jim Daniels on NBC Sports Radio, where every day is game day. And now, it's Jim Daniels.
Thanks for dialing us up. Lots of ways for you to get our programming. We appreciate it. NBC Sports Radio, NBCSportsRadio.com. Hundreds of radio stations from coast to coast. Sirius Satellite Radio. And, of course, go to our website, NBCSportsRadio.com. Where you can find our stuff on demand. That's right, your favorite shows all over the place and when you want to listen to them. Got a great sports read for you today. A new book argues that gambling played a role in the development of sports and top sporting events like March Madness and the Olympic Games even. It also examines the origins of the world's greatest games, and you may be surprised at some of those revelations. On the origins of sports, the early history and original rules of everybody's favorite games by Gary Belsky and Neil Fine, set for release this week, April 19th. Sports fans regularly, I mean, listen, all the time, spend hundreds of hours and thousands of dollars on tickets and road trips and gear and devote weekends and entire vacations to watch your favorite teams and argue with friends and co-workers over the greatest games and the athlete of all time. Why are sports so important to us? Let's dig in here. Gary Belsky joins us now to discuss the origins of sports. Gary, thanks for being with us this morning. What turned you from a sports fan to a sports sleuth?
Well, I spent a lot of years at ESPN. I was editor-in-chief of the magazine. And when we were there, we were thinking a lot about what is it that, you know, what are these games that hold so much attention? And as a result, we started looking at the origins, the early histories of all these different sports. And we came across a few of the sets of rules that kind of created the modern games as we know it. And I always sort of had that in my back pocket. And my partner and I pitched a book, and our publishers liked it, of looking at every major sport and a few curious ones and trying to find out how did we go from kicking a sheep bladder stuffed with grass to soccer or rugby or football? How did we go from shepherds hitting petrified sheep dung with a shepherd staff to golf or field hockey? And we found the original rules for all of the major sports, and then we kind of looked at them and talked about how we went from those rules in 1750 or 1840 or 1960, whatever the case may be, how we went from those rules to the games that we know and love today.
You know, the book's a great read for every level of sports fan. It's fun stuff. It's easy fare. Now, gambling, that word always raises an eyebrow when spoken in sports circles. But betting was so common in the early days of professional baseball, the gamblers would sit in their own designated section of the stands at some baseball games. That area was called the gambling pool or the betting pool, which sounds a lot like horse racing to me. But do we have the Black Sox really to blame for putting that practice to an end?
Oh, no, not really. The fact of the matter was that even earlier, both in cricket and in baseball, gamblers were part of the reason why there be standardized rules developed, because, you know, gamblers wanted to be able to bet on individual events and outcomes of games, and everybody had to agree on what those events, what events were legal and what you know, what the games were about. And so there was a lot of gambling interest in the early days of cricket and the early days of baseball, but in the mid-1800s in America, when the early professional baseball world developed, the gambling pools were so, and this was the same in England and with cricket, the gambling pools were so noisy and so invasive that they were kicked out, and they used to go hang out in billiards parlors. And so soon those billiards parlors where the gambling pools were hanging out became known as pool parlors, which is why we call billiards pool, because that's where all the gambling pools hung out. But gambling was pushed away, or there was an attempt to push it away from baseball long before the Black Sox, but it never really got very far away. And by the way, it's not far away now. It's legal to bet on baseball games now in Las Vegas and many other places.
Exactly right. You know, this book might be fun to have in your back pocket at the bar, too. Now, let's do this. We've just completed one of the world's great golf tournaments with the Masters at Augusta, a surprise finish for the millions watching on television, to be sure. But in your book, you write that golf is created out of boredom. Shepherds, you alluded to this already, in Scotland would hit frozen sheep dung to pass the time with their staffs. And this activity formed the basis for the game of golf that we watch every weekend. Is that indeed a fact, a true story, and whether the sports were created out of boredom?
Well, I think a lot that is indeed a fact. It happened certainly in Scotland, and it probably also was happening in China at the same time. But the fact of the matter was that, you know, when men or women are have some time on their hands, they tend to sort of throw things or hit things or knock things, and then somebody next to them says, "I can do that a little bit better," or "I can do it a little bit farther," and all of a sudden you've got a, instead of having a, you know, a waste of time for shepherds when the sheep are sleeping, you've got a game and a competition, and soon enough people start to put rules to that competition, and all of a sudden you've got a sport. And that's exactly how golf developed. It developed from boredom. A lot of sports, you know, evolved out of people having too much time in their hands. Much of the Olympic sports, you know, were either a combination of war games and practice, or they were, you know, and people having to practice throwing a spear, which turned into the javelin, or jumping over a lake or small streams, which turned into the pole vault, or it was just people lifting weights or taking target practice and, you know, trying to outdo their friends in the Roman legions. And soon enough, you had archery competitions or caber tosses or things like that. So in general, boredom contributed a lot to the development of sports as we know it.
Gary Belsky is with us this morning. He's written the book On the Origins of Sports, the Early History and Original Rules of Everybody's Favorite Games. This is a fun read. You mentioned the Olympics. The last time golf was an Olympic sport was 1904. The sport is returning, kind of a little bit of a surprise in the timing in this, but the sport is returning as one of the Olympic Games to be played in Rio this summer. What does that say about golf and its worldwide popularity today?
Well, it says that they've survived the fall of Tiger Woods, right? Like, I think everybody thought that when Tiger kind of collapsed and sort of stopped being the main attraction at golf tournaments, that there was going to be a huge dip in interest level. And it turns out there's such a young group of talent that people still want to pay attention to it. And it's one of the true global sports, right? People play golf in on every continent seriously. And I think its return to the Olympics speaks to the fact that the game still holds a lot of interest to people, even though it's often a little bit sleepy to watch and takes a long time to play. But I think, you know, golf has been around literally for about 700 or 800 years. It was so popular, by the way, in the 1400s and the 1500s that it was banned by the King of England because too many soldiers were wasting too much time playing golf. And so I think if it's a sport that needs to be banned by, you know, Henry VIII, it's going to be a sport that's going to do very well in the Olympics.
Awesome. You know, let's shift gears and go here. Player safety has become a hot button issue in every branch of the sports world, with the NFL probably leading the way due to their concussion and CTE issues. Do you believe that sports are more violent today than they were in their infancy?
I don't think the sports are more violent. In fact, I think the sports themselves are less violent, but I think the players and the equipment is so much better that the level of physical interaction is that much more intense, and players feel more invincible. That is to say, they feel like they can't get hurt because they have such good protection, and that in turn makes them more reckless and more dangerous to each other. But the sports themselves, you know, one of the rules we chose for the beginning of modern football are actually about in 1906, when they were trying to make the sport safer because 19 people died in high school and college football in 1905. So in 1906, they introduced the forward pass as a way to make football more safe. And in fact, it did make it more safe. But the problem now is that the fields are mostly the same size, and the players are bigger, faster, stronger. And so the players are more physically capable of harming each other, even though the rules of the game continue to evolve to make the game safer. That's true, by the way, from football to basketball to hockey to stock car racing, the original rules of which we also have in our book. So in general, the sports are getting safer, but the athletes are getting more powerful.
Gary Belsky is our guest. Let's go to fantasy sports. It's at an all-time high in popularity, but has come under quite a bit of scrutiny lately, certainly from the Justice Department. There is a particular story in your book that talks about the original rules of the first fantasy football league. Actually, how far back does fantasy sports really go?
That's a great question. Yeah, in fact, our book, believe it or not, has a scoop. The original rules of fantasy football have never been published before, and we got a hold of them from one of the original players. Believe it or not, even though fantasy baseball began in 1980 for the most part, and then fantasy football as we know it took off, there was actually a fantasy football league in 1963, and it just nobody knew about it because it was among a group of 8 players in the Oakland area. They were fans, and some of them worked for the Oakland Raiders when they were part of the old American Football Conference, and they developed what was clearly, when you look at the rules, you'll recognize them as that's a fantasy football league, and basically proxy sports, the idea of, you know, playing sports through the statistics of real athletes had been around for about 10 years. They originally started with golf, believe it or not. Somebody had invented a fantasy sport in the 1950s that was around golf. Like, basically, you would pick a group of players before a tournament started, and you would, you know, either win or lose based on how your team did. But that didn't really catch on, and even fantasy football didn't catch on. It stayed with these few people in the Bay Area. But then a guy named Dan Okrent, created, along with about 12 other people, created the Rotisserie Baseball League in New York in 1980, and that launch fantasy sports as we know it.
Yeah, for sure. That is one of the things that propelled it. And, thing with the golf, they're still kind of doing that one, too. On the Origins of Sports, the Early History and Original Rules of Everybody's Favorite Games. The book comes out this Tuesday, April 19th. Where's the best place to secure a copy, Gary?
You can get it at any major bookstore or on online, Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, wherever people buy books. It's available everywhere, and it really is. We really tried to write it so that it would be interesting to the casual sports fan or the serious sports fan. There are stuff for both, we hope, in every chapter.
Yeah, for sure. And like I said, might be a good one to have a paperback copy in the back pocket when you go into the bar to have a little bit of fun. Gary Belsky, fun stuff. Really enjoyed it. Go out and get this one on Tuesday when it comes out, On the Origins of Sports, the Early History and Original Rules of Everybody's Favorite Games. Gary, thanks very much for being with us on NBC Sports Radio.
Thank you, sir.
Really entertaining read and a lot of stuff in there. You'd be surprised at how many things they're able to squeeze into that. Good stuff comes out on Tuesday. All right, coming up next, we'll wrap up this week's edition of Speaking of Sports with little Pete Fox, as we always do. Stay right there, NBC Sports Radio and NBCSportsRadio.com. Final segment of today's edition of Speaking of Sports. I'm Jim Daniels. This is where we kick aside the box score and take a slightly different look at some of the things going on in the sports world. A little less score, a little bit more substance. And in this case, we bring in Pete Fox to talk a little bit of, well, let's go to the NFL. I want to go there. One of the big stories this week in the NFL is what the Rams and the Titans wound up doing. The Titans had announced a number of days ago that they had a deal all set and ready to go for that number one pick, and then they did something that was really a little bit unprecedented, waited, held back to make their news. You know, Los Angeles is a Lakers town. It's always going to be a Lakers town, and I think this was a smart move for the returning Rams to kind of back up out of the way, let Kobe have his moment, and then announce it the next day. Do you think that was a good move by the Rams, Pete?
Yeah, it was very cool. It was amazing how they got it done, and you know, because they told the PR department, it wasn't like they really kept it under their vest. Both teams were involved. The Titans signed off on it too and said, yeah, we'll wait. We won't say anything. So they told their PR departments, and the PR department was able to kind of keep it quiet for 24 hours, which in this day and age with social media, stuff leaks all the time. So it was pretty amazing they were able to get that done and not steal the limelight from Kobe's final night.
Which was amazing in and of itself, where Kobe Bryant put up 50 shots, knocked down 60 points with it in that final game, with everybody on the floor in a Laker uniform, minute they touched the ball, firing it right back to Kobe, telling him all game long, just shoot, 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 and see what happens. And the Mamba put on quite a final performance, didn't he?
It was great, yeah. It was a very cool experience to be in the building. The crowd was just, anytime Kobe wasn't playing, it was a very quiet, silent, empty feeling in the building. But when he was on the floor, everyone was just excited whenever he touched the ball. And then every shot he made, the place would erupt. And you could tell he was dog tired in the final minutes of the game there, but kept pushing through. And it was just, he called it surreal. And I think that's the best word to describe it. It was just a very, very cool experience.
Back to the Rams, there is rumblings that they might be willing to trade that number one pick that they just got, thinking that they can get the quarterback that they want a little bit lower in the draft. Do you think they hold on to this pick, or is that going to be the next move? Is another trade?
God, it seems like they would hold on to it because the feeling is they need a quarterback, and with the number one pick, obviously you can get the best one. But there is a possibility that they can't make up their mind as to which one of the two, Goff or Wentz, is the one they should go with. So
who is the best one? In your opinion?
I like Wentz. I like Wentz.
Do you?
I mean, based on what I've seen from his like pro day, I know that's a cherry situation where everything is set up perfectly for you to succeed. Uh-huh. But to me, it seems like Wentz is not by much. I mean, they're both they both seem like they could have viable NFL careers. Are they superstars? I don't know. But it seems like Wentz has all the tools to be a very good NFL quarterback. But again, it's just so hard to tell. I mean, the number one pick is so important for any team. And I can see how the Rams are contemplating back and forth as to which one of these two guys is the right guy. But I don't know what else they're going to learn in the final 2 weeks either. So you figure they just have to make up their mind and go with that. I would be really surprised if you go through all that, you empty the cupboards, you give all those picks to the Titans to get the number one pick, and then you trade it again. That would be a very, very interesting move.
Now, the flip side of that is the Titans. Do you think there's enough talent in this draft that they have made this move and they're going to be able to really bolster their lineup significantly with all these draft picks?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot. All of these picks are 76 and above. So that's pretty much the cream of the crop of this NFL draft. And generally speaking, the middle, you know, second and third rounds is where you get a lot of value, and that's what the Titans need. They have so many holes, especially on offense, at the line position. They need to fill a lot of different things, and I think having those that many picks is going to be huge for them. I mean, it may not materialize right away. It's going to take a year or two, but when you're as bad as they have been over the past few years, yeah, all those picks are – there's no way that can't help. There's just no way.
Quickly, the NBA has approved the sale of jersey sponsorship. We're going to start seeing a little 2.5 by 2.5 inch patch, not next year, but in the 2017-18 season. Do you think they've opened Pandora's box here? Are we going to see this on every sports uniform in the next 10 years?
Is this the first, Jim, where I ask you the question and then you return it to me? I don't think that's ever happened before. I think it's awesome. I am a capitalist when it comes to this stuff because I love advertising. You know, I mean, it's what we do to a certain extent. And I've always said, like, look, if you could get someone to pay you money, then you should take that money. Take it.
And you're worth exactly what you can get, right?
Right.
Exactly. Awesome stuff. Pete, thanks very much. Look forward to this part of the show every week. Thank you very much. Coming up next on many of these NBC Sports Radio stations, it's Coop. Stay tuned. It's NBC Sports Radio.